Castle. We've been cycled. This is our last afternoon for the close application of mindfulness to feelings arising in the body, or more broadly, these feelings arising in conjunction with our experience of the sensory world. So, just a few closing comments on this as you go into this. Your shamatha, as we'll see when we move tomorrow, is settling the mind in its natural state and closely applying mindfulness to the mind, that your shamatha is going to kind of be your base, your home, your seat, so to speak. You can rest there and then venture out. So there you retreat into your seat, retreat into shamatha, and then when it seems appropriate, you go on your expedition, venturing out and really attending to feelings arising here and so forth, and likewise, as we'll see tomorrow, feelings arising in the mind, but taking a special interest in them, focusing on them. But this is a very rich practice. So overall, this whole matrix of the four applications of mindfulness, and one of the themes that occurs for every one of the four is one attends closely to the factors of origination, the factors of disillusion. So this shows quite clearly that this must entail more than just moment-to-moment bare attention. Because when it's seen, the feelings arising within a fabric, within a network. And so, in modern psychology, when we're looking for triggers for emotions, for example, it's a central theme of Paul Ekman's work. What triggers if you get irritated or anxious or feelings low self-esteem or what have you? Okay, there's the emotion, fine. But it didn't come out of the blue. What triggered it? Or do certain people trigger a certain type of response to you? So, in anticipation, before you meet them, you could recognize, oh, I'm meeting this person, so now be especially aware of, this person, that what might be triggered here. So you become well prepared, right? Well, that's included in the term is contemplation. That is the wise attending to, the discerning, the reflective, sometimes cogitating, sometimes thinking, about the factors that give rise to, in this case, feelings arising in the body. So what was that network? What was that concatenation? It's a nice word, that network of substantial causes and cooperative conditions that come together and then from moment to moment are giving rise to whatever feelings are arising in the body. So the factors of origination, and then of course once the feeling has arisen, then attending closely to it, permanent, impermanent, how does it fit into that whole framework of sukha and dukkha? And then of course, is there anything there intrinsically, I or mine? So these are the questions that kind of are there in the background, that inform, that illuminate, that provide greater penetrating insight into our close application of mindfulness to the feelings, and then of course the factors of disillusion. How do they fade out? But also within the causal network, what do the feelings themselves arising in the body, what do they trigger? Because as all substantial causes, all substantial causes are also cooperative conditions for something else. And so there are the feelings. Well, the feelings will be giving rise to more feelings. But in the meantime, the feelings can trigger thoughts. They can trigger memories. They can trigger all kinds of things, acting as a cooperative condition for other types of events. So it's really a kind of a three-dimensional whole network, or matrix, to use a cool term, of causality taking place here. And so seeing the feelings arising embedded in this whole framework then really drains them, in a way, of the notion that somehow they are hard, they're intrinsic, they're absolute, they stand in and of themselves, inherent, existent. So by this close attending to these three factors of impermanence, the nature of dukkha, the nature of non-self, we're already softening up the reification of feelings as inherently existent, absolutely real, from their own side. And there's the mudra, of course, the fist, right? So factors of origination, factors of disillusion, while they're present, totally closely attending to the manner in which they're present. And then there's one more theme, I think then we'll go to the meditation. And it comes up again for all of the applications of mindfulness. And it's often translated, I think, incorrectly. Now, this is a translator's debate, okay? So I'm not here to debate with anybody, but I will say that there are different views here. And a common translation is one attends to the body in the body. One attends to feelings in feelings, attends to the mind in the mind, and so forth. So the preposition in, right? If you read any of the translations, They'll often say that, not always, but that's the more standard translation. By very good translators. By very good translators. Okay? And I think they're wrong. And I think they're wrong. I don't read Pali, but I read pretty good Tibetan. And a lot of the grammar is actually, it follows. There's strong parallels there. And I think the prepositions are one of them. To my mind, it just doesn't, I don't find much juice to bring to the practice, okay, now I'm going to observe my body in my body. That just kind of sounds like bad grammar to me. How many bodies do you have? Here's the body, and then I'm going to observe it in the body. In the body. Like what do we have, Russian dolls here? And so maybe there's a really sensible, I mean, since there's some translators who translate in that way are very good translators, I'm sure they have something intelligent to say there. So I'm not ridiculing anything here. It's simply I disagree. And I think a more valuable, to my mind, a practical and more valuable way of translating is simply one views the body as the body. Views feelings as feelings. Mental events as mental events. Instead of in, as. I find that more useful. And I think that's very much in accordance with the Buddhist teachings to Bahia in this seeing, let there be justice seeing. In other words, you're seeing the visual impressions as visual impressions. You're just seeing them for what they are. And likewise, and Jenny said the sounds for tactile sensation, for mental events, you're seeing them as what they are. Very much, many, I think not only very much, exactly like when you're dreaming, view the dream as a dream. And not as something else that it's not, namely waking reality. So I think that's what the Buddha was getting at, to Bahia, be lucid in the waking state, and see things as they are, see mental events as mental events, don't conflate them with their reference, which we very often do. We'll be sitting there quietly, you know, and conflating our thoughts with whatever the reference of the thoughts are, thinking they're totally the same. That's where the, in terms of OCDD, that's where the final D comes in. Obsessive, compulsive, and then delusion. Because we're actually conflating, thinking whatever I'm thinking must be true. That's the whole truth, and I think that's true. That's delusion. So here, when we're attending to the feelings arising in the body, observe them, attend to them, simply as feelings, with no additions, no ornamentation, no clothing, no cloaking, no superpositions, just see them nakedly, see feelings as feelings. And as you do so, and this is where we'll segue to the meditation and then segue to tomorrow also, and that is when you see feelings arising in the body, then notice that these are feelings which are a way of experiencing tactile sensations. And I'll stand by that hypothesis. That really worked for me. It's not something objectively appearing to you. It's a way of experiencing earth, water, fire, air, whatever tactile sensations are presenting themselves to you within this somatic field. So those feelings are arising. But now we're also aware, we know this every single day, that as we have feelings arising in the body, then we're experiencing those feelings not only with tactile consciousness, but also with what other kind of consciousness. Keep your hands away.
Yeah.
Are you each there? But go ahead and say it, Maya. Mental consciousness, yeah. So mental consciousness, this is really a core theme of Buddhist psychology altogether. And once again, it makes an awful lot of sense to me. Of course we're thinking of the tactile perception. That's what I'm getting right there. But when I'm attending to it, when I'm focusing on it, so I'm rubbing my knee there, I'm picking up tactile sensation, but I'm paying attention. And now my mental awareness is also going to those tactile sensations. So mental awareness, unlike all of the five sensory modes of consciousness, can piggyback on the other five. You can't visually attend to sounds. You can't, with your auditory awareness, you can't piggyback on the smells. There's no auditory perspective on smells. Because they have their own category, they have their own domain, and they're in the Buddhist view, they're non-overlapping. What you see, but you don't hear. What you hear, you don't smell, and so forth. So the five physical senses, in the Buddhist view, true or false, non-overlapping. Okay? But when it comes to mental consciousness is the one that can, it's like the monkey that can go through all six windows. Right. So visual just gets to look out the visual window. And auditory only have auditory window. But the mental consciousness, it can and does scurry around for all the windows, including having its own domain, which none of the five physical senses can see into. You can't visually see into your mind. You can't hear into your mind. You can only pick up your thoughts, images, dreams, and so forth with mental consciousness. Right? But mental consciousness, while it has its own turf, its own unique turf, mental consciousness can jump into, and it basically kind of is parasitic, goes in conjunction with any of the other five physical senses. So when you are closely applying mindfulness to feelings arising in the body, then there's a tactile awareness of the sensations, and together with that tactile awareness, there will be an affective quality, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. But when you're closely applying mindfulness, which means you're really paying attention, what are you piggybacking onto that tactile awareness? Mental awareness. But mental consciousness comes with its own feeling. Now, very, very often, its own feeling kind of bleeds over from the tactile over to the mental. Or you're seeing something that, as you're visually perceiving something, there's a sense of pleasure, oh, that's pretty, and then mental consciousness comes in, and you mentally feel really happy. Right? But now that in the body, it's especially obvious. Imagine that you go to a masseuse, and you ask, give me a really strong massage. I really want you to get in and use some muscle, because I got some deep tension, so get in there. Get in there. And then the person does, maybe like the Thai masseuses, they use their elbows, right? And they really get in there. And if you really want it, and you know you're getting right where you really need it, when that elbow goes in, you say, that really hurts. Because it hurts in a really good way. So tactfully, it doesn't feel good, but when the elbow goes right where you know it needs to, you go, there. So it's a clear, we say, disparity between sheer raw tactile feeling, and how does it feel, good or bad? Would you rather have this or this? You know, not a nice, slightly gentle stroke. Well, this is unpleasant, but you don't want this. You want, give me the elbow. And so tactile is uncomfortable, but mentally, yeah, I want her again. She's got great elbows. She really knows how to use those elbows. You know? And so there, mentally you're really enjoying, and physically, yes, uncomfortable. But you know, yeah, this is just the kind of discomfort I want, because this is going to really, I'll feel so much looser, so much better afterwards. So that can happen. Right. And of course it can happen that you injure yourself, or maybe you have arthritis, or you have some other kind of physical discomfort, and there's the physical discomfort arising. And then on top of that, why do I have to experience this? Oh man, this is such a drain. I hate this. Wow. Man, what a bummer. Poor me. And so then the mental awareness is kind of almost like osmosis. It's picking up the feeling from the tactile, and it's going along with that. Now you're getting a double whammy. You're getting unpleasant and unpleasant. Unpleasant physically and unpleasant mentally. Right? But they don't have to go together. And that's where some freedom lies. That if your body is injured, it's ill, or there's something damaged in the body, then it should be sending you pain signals. Otherwise, you'd never be alerted. You'd have no incentive to fix it. Like the girl could pluck out her eyes and not feel anything at all. Not even mentally. Because there was nothing to trigger until she says, oh, I can't see out of that eye anymore. Too late. But seeing that they don't need to go along together. Well, how do you get to that? By simply seeing feelings as feelings and letting your awareness have its own autonomy. Your mental consciousness and the feelings going along with mental consciousness. So what you definitely can achieve here in this practice is if unpleasant feelings are arising in the body, there they are, you're attending to them, but mentally, the mental consciousness of those feelings, mentally you can have a neutral feeling. A neutral feeling. Even though the feeling in the body, painful, mentally the feeling could be, this is interesting. This is what's called exploring the nature of feelings. Or it might even be, if you get some insight, like, whoa, this is an interesting practice. Let's go and investigate metaphysical pain a little bit more. This is getting interesting. And then you might actually have some mental, as you're interested in the practice, you're enjoying the practice. Mentally, wow, this is interesting. I'm actually getting to know the nature of feelings. Mentally, some physical, some mental happiness could arise. Even while the feelings in the body you're attending to may be somewhat unpleasant. If they're searingly painful, not so likely. But if they're merely just not uncomfortable, good. So do explore, because often we may feel that our mental feelings are simply enslaved by the feelings arising in the body. And they are enslaved by the feelings arising in the body, even only if you let them. But you don't have to. There really isn't a possibility of freedom there. Okay? So, now that you've done a long preamble, I can give very few words. We practice the new practice now, but again, when you can just enrich your mindfulness. This came up in one conversation today. Where is that demarcation? Where is that border between simply attending, as in kind of their attention, simply being mindful, is in contrast to vipassana, inquiring into, contemplating. And so exactly where is that border? And the answer, as I gave to answer to somebody who came into a meeting today, is the border is fuzzy. It should be fuzzy. Right? Sometimes insights may come when you're just quietly attending and then something really comes in. But where the insight deepens is that you're knowing something. For example, you're just knowing the impermanent nature, the constantly flux nature, or fluctuating nature, momentary nature of feelings. And you are experiencing them. And then it's kind of like knowing that you're experiencing them. I'm coming this to you, to a number of you, when you're doing the practice, it's not only important to do the practice correctly, but while you're doing it correctly, to know that you're doing it correctly. Then you have that confidence. It's like countersinking, what do you call it? When you hammer a nail in, and then you countersink. So you hammer a nail in, and then you put a little pivot on top of it, and you countersink it. So it even goes down beneath the surface of the wood, right? That means it's really in there. It's called countersinking a nail. So it's in, and then it's really in, okay? So practicing correctly is good. But knowing that you're practicing correctly, that's countersinking the nail. Then it really goes in. So it's fine to be aware of, to know the impermanent nature of feelings, to know that phenomena themselves are not intrinsically pleasurable or unpleasurable. It's perfectly good to see them simply as events and to know that they are not I or mine. But then to know that you know, oh, that really goes to you. That's when you're counter-seeking it. That's when it really penetrates. And that can have a more indelible, a deeper, more transformative effect. And you really get it. It's really hammering and it's penetrating into your psyche. Oh, now I really get it. I've heard many people, I guess, again, especially in just one-on-one meetings, saying, I've heard you say this for a long time. And then yesterday, I really got it. It really came through. I really got it experientially. Now, I understood it before, but yesterday, well, then I really got it. That was countersinking a nail. That one, it goes, and the thing about countersinking a nail is, it's going to be really hard for that nail to come out. You know? I mean, it's really gone in, kind of like almost part of the wood now. It's so deeply in there. You'd have to rip the wood apart to get that nail. And that's what we want. We want the inside to go in so deep that it actually becomes part of your way of viewing reality. And not simply something you know or you believe, but you actually view reality. Okay, I'll ask you. Find a comfortable position. Or uncomfortable if you like. It's your turn. Step by step, settle your body, your speech, your respiration, and your mind in their natural states. And for a little while, calm the discursive mind, stem the flow of rumination. Be mindful as a breathing, relaxing and releasing fully with every hour. now like a bright light filling the room. Let the light of your mindfulness fill the space of the body, both on the interior as well as on the exterior. And let your baseline, your flow of continuity, be that ongoing flow of sensations associated with the breath. You just keep in touch with that, something constant. As if you're on a boat which gently rises and falls as the waves pass through. But let that be more of a peripheral awareness or a secondary awareness while you turn your interest to the rising and passing of fields, arising, occurring within this field of tactile experience. Again, a sure giveaway of this is if you feel any impulse to move, chances are that was triggered by a feeling. Instead of moving, observe the feeling that triggered the desire to move. Apart from the movement of the breath, be very still. Now make use of the versatility of your mental breath. It is your choice whether you focus your mental awareness on the tactile sensations themselves of earth, water, fire, and air, or whether you focus on the feelings associated with your tactile experience of those sensations. Focus on the feelings and observe the impact on the feelings of your focused attention directed upon them. The role of introspection is equally important in the practice of shamatha as well as in vipassana. Now we are focusing on mindfulness, on feelings arising within the space of the body. With introspection, monitor the flow of mindfulness, noting the occurrence of excitation or laxity as usual. Also, more broadly, introspection is focused not just on the mind, but the flow of mindfulness. In the Buddhist meaning of term introspection also that faculty by means of which we monitor our own bodies, in this case the posture. See that you continue to settle the body in its natural state. Again, your faculty of introspection. Monitor also the flow of the breath. Your outer Vipassana practice. The breath should flow as effortlessly, as unimpededly, as in the Shamatha practice of mindfulness of breathing. And a brief recap. As you closely apply mindfulness to the feelings in the body, observe them as feelings, just for what they are, with no conceptual additions. Contemplate the factors of origination and of dissolution. And observe the three marks of existence. Permanence, the edge of dukkha, and non-self. Finally, any time during the session, if you'd like to retreat for a little while, you can always just settle back into mindfulness of breathing, back into shavasana. Take a breather. When you feel refreshed, and venture forth once again into the expedition of Vipassana. Let's continue practicing now in silence. So now the final instruction, the plus application of mindfulness to feelings arising in the body, or by way of the five physical senses, which is not really so applicable or useful when you're formally in meditation, sitting quietly, perhaps with the eyes closed, but enormously useful in between sessions. So very integral, and as far as I can tell, hardly ever taught nowadays. But the Buddha taught it, that's good enough for me. But not only did, actually I must say, there are elements, certain aspects of the teachings of the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutta, that I think people really would either find very feasible to practice, or wouldn't really want to practice. In which case, why teach it? So, I won't give examples, or shall I give one? Watching the stages of decomposition of human corpse. Number one, it's not that easy to find. In Asia, where, you know, classical Asia, you could, you could get the charnel grounds. It can be quite effective. Quite effective. During the time of the Buddha, there was one, apparently just an incredibly gorgeous woman. I think she was a courtesan. And she just suddenly died. She just got ill, and 2 days later, now she's dead. But she was just strikingly, just gorgeous. And, you know, the monks were on their arms around, they probably saw her, and they would notice, you know. And so when she died, then her body was placed out in the charnel ground, and the Buddha said, "Okay, monks, feast your eyes." And as the days went by, they just watched a ravishingly beautiful body become naught. Really good medicine for monks. Because a monk really does not want to. I was a monk for 14 years. A monk, if you're an authentic monk, and I think most are, you don't want to experience lust. If you want to experience lust, then you would become a monk and you have sex whenever you could. But if you can't monk, you don't want to experience lust. You certainly don't want to act on it. Otherwise, it just keeps going opposite directions. So that actually is very effective, like that. But I don't teach it. Even though the Buddha did, I don't. So I've been selective. But now here's a theme that comes up every single time, the body, feeling, mind, and phenomena, every single time. And it's there kind of like the pièce de résistance, you know, the final tone. And that is attending, and you've heard it before, attending internally, and externally. With the body, there it is. We see people's bodies. So that's pretty easy. But now, even though that with no clairvoyance or anything like that, by closely attending to people's body language, but especially the face, this is just like a television of just expression. We have 35 muscle groups here, and they're showing emotions all the time, not only emotion, mental emotion, but also physical pleasure shows in the face. Physical distress shows in the face. So that's a big one. But also body language, the way people move, and so forth. So we attend to feelings in our own bodies. Very good. Get it up close, personal. Get it from the inside out. You know what feelings are in the body because you're getting them from the first person perspective. And that's the most accurate thing you'll get is knowing your own feelings. Not to say they'll be infallible, but boy, you definitely have privileged access to the feelings arising in your own body. So get that really nailed. Understand it closely, right? But then as we're attending to the bodies of other people, no, we can't see their feelings. We can't pick it up with a scientific instrument either. But, and here I have a question that I know my intuition says, and I don't know whether it's true or not. When we observe another person who's in pain, and we see it maybe in the facial expression, is this a matter of inference? Now, inference is definitely using the higher cognitive faculties, using reason, using language. Oh, I know there is fire on the yonder side of that mountain because I see smoke. That's a classic inference. We see the effect, and on the basis of the effect, we infer the cause. Happens all the time, right? So it's very cognitive. We know that's the nature of inference. It's very cognitive, right? We're figuring something out. It may be very quick, but nevertheless, it's cognitive. Is that what's happening? I have a question here. I know my own intuitive response, but again, I don't know whether it's true or false. I just know that my intuitive response. That if I should gaze over at Patrice, for example, and it's not true right now, but if I saw her, something in her face or body language, and it was quite evident that she's in pain, then maybe you can attend and so forth, you know, like that. If I were attending to her and seeing her, or for that matter, if I hear her moaning, I mean, the pain is really coming out. I don't need to give a moan. You know what a moan is like, but I'm hearing that. And I'm looking over there and I'm saying, oh, a moan is not a feeling. It's a sound. We can all mimic it. We can all pretend to be moan as if you're in pain. We can all do that. We don't have to be actors. But moaning, seeing facial expression, maybe feeling physical activity. It's a question you might just want to go back to your experience. I'm using words, inviting you to go back into your experience and not just think more. But when you attend to a person like that, maybe you hear the moaning, you see facial expression, maybe you see them holding their arm, clutching their arm like that. Are you inferring their pain? Like you infer fire when you see smoke? Or is there something more immediate? My sense is it's more immediate. Even though, no, I can't experience her pain, it's way over there, it's her nerve endings, not mine. And she could be faking, she could be moaning, just pretending. She could be just pretending, and so forth and so on. But my sense is it's something deeper than that. It's something more visceral than simply a cognitive act of independence upon those effects, the moaning, the facial expression, and her gripping her arm. Therefore, I am inferring there must be a cause, and the cause must be physical pain, like fire. I've seen the effects, inferring. It may be that. Maybe it's just really quick, and that's what it is, cognitive. And maybe it's not. Maybe it's not. My sense is, but I can't really explain it. I think it's something deeper, something more intuitive. Maybe it's nowhere more evident than when a mother suddenly sees her child in pain. It's hard to imagine. I'm not a mother. I don't know what it's like to have a mother added towards her own child. But it just strikes me intuitively. Once again, it's not simply an inference. Number one, she may feel pain. She may feel a spasm in her body. And it could be a father, it could be a sibling, a lover, a spouse. But you feel it, right? I don't think it's just cognitive. It may be on a deeper level. So that's for you to investigate. But the point here is very simple, and that is we can attend to feelings in others' body, with or without clairvoyance. And even if it's cognitive, well, it's cognitive with quite a big punch. And maybe it's something deeper than that. But it's clear. We can, as we attend closely to others' bodies, we can attend to their feelings in their body. It may not be infallible, but then exactly which mode of perception is infallible, right? But it can be highly accurate. And so that's part of the practice. We're attending to feelings internally, attending to feelings, physical feelings, externally. And then as we engage in conversation, or in wrestling, or in shaking a hand, whatever it may be, just any type of engagement, verbal, physical, and so forth, then we observe feelings internally and externally. How is my engagement with this person influencing this person's feelings? Masseuses do that all the time. They have to. That has to be part of the job description, right? And other people working in body work. You're going in there, right? You're going in there. Of course you feel the feelings in your own body. And of course you're observing the feelings, attending closely to the feelings in your clients or the patient's body. But boy, there you are moment by moment, attending to what's the dynamic, right? Too much, too little, different, how shall I alter? That's an ongoing processing. That's internally and externally. Body workers all know that better than I do. I'm not a body worker, okay? So there's that. So there's just a tremendous, I'm pretty enthusiastic. There's just such a richness in this practice. It's just a richness of practice. It's just like giving us a 1,000-watt light bulb and saying, would you like to turn this on in your life? No. Until now, you may just have been experiencing feelings. Any goat can do that. And what do? We identify with them, and then we don't want the bad ones, and we want the good ones. Welcome to being a sentient being. And it's not really going anywhere. It's just experiencing your feelings and reacting to them. This is shining a bright light of intelligence, discernment, mindfulness, samadhi, to really understand the nature of these phenomena that we already care so deeply about. That's why the Buddha said this all by itself, feelings, as a wide array of mental factors and processes. He picked this one up and said, this deserves its own sunnah, its own category. Okay? So, those are the teachings. That pretty well completes what I'd like to share with you. about close application of mindfulness to feelings in the body. And then I want one up. I, it's my choice. Oh, that's for now, that's question nine. And we start. Okay. Well, long, I'm looking for short. That's a lucky one. Okay. Okay, here's a more theoretical one. I have doubt, are there two different qualities or levels of direct realization of emptiness? Well, not for the use of the word direct. Are there different levels of realization of emptiness? Yes. If we're using the word direct, what that means, if from the Tibetan or Sanskrit or Buddhist literature, is that means conceptually unmediated. Well, no, either you have conceptually unmediated, non-conceptual direct realization of emptiness, or not. But if you do, then that's that. So there's no gradations there, right? But are there stages of insight, of understanding, of experience, of realization, prior to absolutely non-conceptual, utterly unmediated direct realization of emptiness? The answer is yes. Just like with great love, just like with impermanence, nature, dukkha, and so forth, yeah, there's a whole gradation. Again, very much like, how lucid are you in the dream? Well, there's all kinds of gradations, okay? So, one, you realize by close inspection of phenomena, the other you realize by the eye of wisdom, probing how they emerge, what's their nature, shouldn't the direct realization be? Two, thank you, this is from Francesca. It's a very good question. So, the answer here is quite interesting. And that is, what we're speaking, right now we're in Shravaka. I want to linger there, and not kind of, that's for inferior people, let's get on the Mahayana. That's not for inferior people, that's like for people like me. And yes, inferior, but not absolutely. But the Shravakayana is primarily focused experientially and methodologically, in terms of Vipassana. This close application of mindfulness is just classic. This is just the paradigm of, let's see, in the teachings in the Pali Canon. This is a paradigm, the exemplar. What's Vipassana like? Well, look in the Sabdatansit. That's really classic. And what does it entail? Closely applying mindfulness to the specific characteristics of phenomena, but also the more general ones. All composite phenomena are impermanent, not just your body, not just feelings. So it's investigating the specific qualities and also the more general qualities shared by other phenomena. And so it's this close application, and we're targeting these three really core elements of our existence, and that is impermanence, dukkha, and non-self. And so what's the culmination of that? Is a very clear perception, way of apprehending, what's actually going on in this phenomenal world, that is in our bodies, our feelings, but in sentient beings around us in the whole environment, that we're actually viewing all phenomena that are impermanent as impermanent. And never cluttering that up with a junk we superimpose, viewing that which is by nature unsatisfying as unsatisfying. In other words, really knowing what are the true sources of well-being, of genuine happiness, and of suffering, and seeing that, viewing reality in that way. And then likewise, viewing reality, actually seeing phenomena as not I am. So in other words, it is a true revolution in the way we're experiencing reality. And that means how we're experiencing is, and bear in mind, this is Sapranta again, I'm bringing that philosophy in, is that you are perceiving phenomena which are real, they're actually arising through your perceptions, six modes of perception. They are directly perceived, they are impermanent, they are real, and you're seeing them as they are, devoid of self. But that means you're seeing, but devoid of the delusional imputation, grasping of self, but you're seeing them as they are. You're seeing non-self, not by seeing non-self over there in some other realm, but seeing phenomena as non-self, seeing them as empty of. But that means you're seeing them clearly with no obscuration and no distortion, right? On the one hand. But now, breaking down the barriers of seeing the impermanent as permanent, that which is by nature unsatisfying as the veritable source of happiness, and that which is by nature non-self, higher mind, as being higher mind, having broken down those barriers and seeing phenomenal reality as it is in terms of those three elements, those three aspects, marks of existence, then having broken down the barriers of those misapprehensions in reality, now you are poised to realize nirvana. And nirvana is unconditioned. It's not impermanent. It's permanent. It's not dukkha. It's sukha. And it's not self. It's simply what it is. It is unconditioned, unborn, unceasing. And it's of the very nature, the realization of nirvana is the very nature of it is unchangingness. The very experience of nirvana itself. So you break down, it's almost like playing chess. That you have to get to the king, and to get checkmate, you need to get the obstacles out of the way. The rooks and the knights and so forth and so on. And then you close in, and then you get the king. Right? And then checkmate. So you have to knock out these barriers of misapprehension, opening up the way until you probe right into, by way of origination. This is a very powerful way of doing it. By now just Satipatthana Sutta, by closely examining the factors of origination and the factors of disillusion, of arising and cessation, then you go right into the unconditioned nature. Now, according to Theravada, as well as all the rest of Buddhism, when you're having a direct non-conceptual realization of nirvana, the entire phenomenal world vanishes. It's gone. Because your mind is now absorbed in the samadhi of nirvana itself. Okay? So there are teachings on emptiness in the Pali Canon. They are there. They're simply not as elaborated, as clear, as detailed as you get in the Prajnaparamita or Lamajun. So, there's that. Does that answer the question? Enough for now. Okay. Hola. This one's for Hans Ketchup. So according to Sattvantika philosophy. According to Sattvantika philosophy, we can observe eye glasses directly, and we infer that they are existing and real. The ownership, as you explained, is existing, yet not real. It is merely a social agreement. Okay? So far, that's exactly what I guess. Simultaneously, as we look at the glasses or the cell phone, it is evident that a range of processes have led to the manifestations of these items. A social scientist, yeah, so now we look at all the ways that our experience is configured by personal history, language, social environment, so forth. I think that's where you're going. And why modern cognitive psychologists, I think the vast majority of them will tell us that all of our experience of the world is saturated by concepts. That's probably it. So let's see where you're going. A social scientist might here argue that, in a sense, these items have a history of their own, meaning that their biography is entangled with a host of activities that includes human endeavor, for example, people involved in various stages of the item's creation, design, productivity, assembly, distribution, and so forth. That is, one may look at a pair of glasses, which I'm wearing, and where are my glasses? And, you know, there are designer glasses. I never own them, but there are designer glasses. Like, whoa, oh, that's a Pierre Cardin, is that one? Is that true? Pierre Cardin?
Yes.
I never bought any of them. Ooh, those are Pierre Cardin glasses. And then, oh, it's got a French name. It must be very good. Whatever. So you're quite right that it's not just seeing glasses. I mean, number one, the very category of glasses is something we learn. We don't just pick it up from perception. But take these down to some I don't know, tribe who's never seen eyeglasses, and they may say, what's this for? Useless. Very bad spoon. So you're quite right. The point is exactly right, so let's be honest. This line of thought has led some scholars to argue that there's a profoundly relational aspect if we look at the process behind things. Well, I think they're right, yeah. It's not simply a looking and then, boom, eyeglasses come to you, or let alone cell phone. We didn't even have cell phones like this. You know, not long ago. You say, what is this? It's a mini computer, that's what that is. And it does so many things. Why are we calling it a phone? I mean, I never use it as a phone. For me, this is a meditation timer. A very expensive meditation timer. That's all it is. It's just a meditation timer. But occasionally, yeah, when I was in Mongolia, it was a camera. So there it is. So what is it? Well, it's absolutely embedded in this very, very rich fabric of process behind things. So my question is the Sattvantika framework addresses these aspects, and how can we understand processes being past events within the framework of existing, non-existing, real and unreal? That's where it gets really, really interesting. So I think what I'd like to do is have, leave that very juicy, well-informed and thoughtful question. I'd like to leave that hovering. Because if we go back to what psychologists, philosophers especially, philosophers might call qualia, or they often call it very sense data. Okay, so I'm going to give a word to it, but I'm getting it without having a word, shiny black. Whether I know the word shiny black, what if my cultural background is and so forth, but there's something here that's pretty primitive. And also like hard and so forth. And so when it comes to these raw sense data or qualia, then one might say, well, that may be at a level where it's kind of prior to, influenced by acculturation, language, personal history, who made it, you know, well, it may be more primitive than that. In which case we might say, okay, well, this is just real, this is directly perceived, and that's it, regardless of acculturation. But as soon as we move to this area, and this gets very, very, very interesting, and also give you a big, great big hint, when I introduced Santratika, I said, like classical physics, and that's the union of Newtonian mechanics and classical and electromagnetism. It's brilliant and tremendous pragmatic results. And just in terms of making the world intelligible, incredible, just the degree of genius intelligence went into the fusion of these two systems to call classical physics, which had its heyday in the 19th century. It's brilliant. And having said that, there were core assumptions that weren't so much introduced by Newton or later people working in mechanics or electromagnetism. It's not so much that they introduced these assumptions, but rather never questioned them. And so they got just picked right up in because nobody thought to question, like absolute space, time, matter, and energy. Right? They weren't being questioned prior to Galileo, prior to Copernicus. It was kind of like, why would anybody question that? Newton didn't question it, and it wasn't questioned really. Absolute space, time wasn't, well, I won't give the whole history of science here. Ernst Mach is an interesting figure. I'll just leave it at that. But the point here is that there were assumptions that were included in this brilliant framework that turned out to be absolutely false. When you're dealing with macro objects traveling at relatively slow speeds, it doesn't matter because it has no empirical consequences. But it's still false. Absolute space, time, matter, and energy. But as soon as you start traveling at relativistic speeds or velocities, and as soon as you start going down to the atomic and subatomic level, then it's obvious they're false. Right? And there are really matters, empirically matters. So in a similar fashion, I think the parallel is actually quite neat. In a similar fashion, this Santratika view is not adopting assumptions that we didn't have already, introducing fresh Buddhist illusions. But this Santratika view that I just outlined some of its really core themes is not questioning some assumptions we've already held. It just brings them right in. Okay? So when it comes to, this is dark, let's say this the color of this eyeglass case here is navy blue. Well, whatever color you call it, that's what it is. Right? And whatever you call that, earth element or plastic element, whatever you call that, it's just hard. And it doesn't matter what you think about it, that's it. It just keeps on being the same. There it is. And so there's that level. But as soon as we move to the level of objects that have attributes, like this eye-class carrier, what we're calling now is an eye-class carrier that has the quality of, it has color. Does it have a color or not? I mean, sure, it's blue. That's the color of the, it's an attribute of the eye-class carrier. Does it have a mass? Does it have, is it heavy or is it light? Yes, is it smooth or is it rough? Does it have a quality of smoothness or roughness? Does it have spatial dimension? Does it have? And does it make noise? Yes, it makes that noise when it struck on my head. It makes that noise, the contact makes that noise. Or it makes its own noise when it's open and closed. And so it has, this object now has all of this attribute. It's a noisy eye case. Most are silent. This is quite a conversation. We have a good conversation with frogs. What is it that has? What is it that has? And are we perceiving the eyeglass case that has all those attributes? Are we seeing that in the same way that we perceive thought? That gets interesting. So we'll pursue that a little bit later. So let's hold these questions in mind, but I think it's kind of philosophically very rich and provocative question. It can take us deeper into questioning assumptions that we may not have gotten around to questioning yet. You're going to add, moreover, not simply as intellectual curiosity, that has its own value, but actually this nature that has a real pragmatic value of seeing deeper into nature. So I'll return to it. Very interesting question. And one that has been addressed, for sure, in Buddhist philosophy and meditation as well. Okay, good. Is it possible to have, this is from Sandra. Right, thank you. This is from Sandra. Is it possible to have a non-conceptualization of loving kindness? When we encounter some being, can we even not think, may you be happy? And so I'm just going to rephrase that and read the rest of your question. May one be attending to another, let's say human being, could be any kind of sentient being, but could one attend to another sentient being with a mind that's very, very quiet, where if you were to check in, you wouldn't hear any talk at all. You wouldn't hear, you'd pick up no denomination, it'd be silent. Could you be attending to another person with a very silent mind? And at the same time, be experiencing loving kindness for that person? The answer is yes. Definitely. No question. And I think many people know that. Again, mothers are just classic. They're not unique. But just gazing at your child sleeping peacefully in the crib, your little baby. And the mother just gazing. And just no commentary. It would be totally done. It would be junk to be looking at them. May you be well and happy. May you be well and happy. What are you saying those words for? This is junk. Right? It's already happened. What are you bringing in the junk for? It's like you've already opened the present. Why are you bringing in the package? So the answer is yes. As, moreover, craving. Now, craving is, as a mental fiction, does ride on the back of, it's carried by conceptualization, but the conceptualization does not need to be chatty. It does not need to be involved in rumination. Rumination, the chit-chat, the discourse in the mind, that's really a course level. But I could be gazing at, I could be craving that bottle of water next to chit-chat. Crave all kinds of things. So let's imagine I'm craving that bottle of water, you know? Like, I wish I had a bottle like that. Why is only the people from the race that I am thinking of bottles like that? Why can't the American listen to bottles? What's wrong with them? Why did they have a corner on the bottle? So it's jealousy, too. But I can be looking at, you know, and I can be looking at something with craving, with attachment, with real greed, without thinking, may I have it, may I have it, may I have it. Just, it doesn't have to be chatty. It is conceptual, but very subtle. So then one needs to see, just like, again, lucidity, that whole bandwidth, likewise conceptual, which is very, very subtle. So I experienced that to think, may you be happy, perpetuated on irrational thinking, and sometimes stops the flow of what I'm feeling. It's very true, it can just be junk. I don't really have words for that feeling, not even loving kindness. So is it possible to even get rid of the word loving kindness, and if so, Am I still doing loving kindness in an appropriate way? Sure, even the word loving kindness, number one, have we ever experienced it before we hear the word metta? Because loving kindness is not part of ordinary language. Love, yes, but then we know it's love for horses, and mothers, and girlfriends, and babies, and art, and sunsets. The word touches such an incredible bandwidth, it's almost useless. In a way, If I say I love you, then what the hell do you mean? Is it lust? Is it sisterly, brotherly, romantic, fatherly? What the hell are you talking about? And that's why this loving kindness is useful, because it only means one thing. It's not all the others. It's not sunsets. It's not lust. It's nothing else. And moreover, it's not a feeling. You know, it's an aspiration. And that's all it is. So it can be towards a beautiful woman or an ugly frog. Or anything in between. The loving kindness can be there, because it's still loving kindness. He's thinking about pretty frogs. What about pretty frogs? Work that way. You have to distinguish your attachment to the pretty frog from the attachment. So the answer is yes. We've experienced loving kindness before we ever hear the word. Tibetans don't have a word in vernacular that they don't have a word for emotion. They don't have a word, it just neatly translates as emotion. Does that mean they have fewer emotions than we do, or that they don't have emotion? That's crazy. And do they even have a simpler array of emotions than people who have the words emotions? I doubt. I really doubt. So we can experience things without having words for them. And sometimes, again, this is the point you might recall, the actual meditative cultivation of loving kindness. We may arouse it with thoughts, with the verses, the phrases, with visualization and so forth. Once that aspiration really starts to flow, then you may bring in just the aspiration, the articulation, the visualization, you may bring it in just once in a while. And when you go more to samadhi in loving kindness, then you may just release the thoughts altogether. And you're just in a flow. It's like falling into a river, just flowing downstream. You're just in a flow of water. And it just doesn't need the packaging. Conceptualization. Very good. Okay, we'll do one more, and then we'll go to another one. And it's from Frank. Frank, say, yeah, I see where you are. There we are. Thank you, Frank. Oh, when taking the domain of mental experience as your object, how can you be certain you have the correct object, especially if there's no gross mental event occurring imagined or occurring? It's a very good question. I presume at this point we are talking about gross mental consciousness, not substrate or other level of consciousness, correct? That is correct, yeah. When we just say, okay, here's do the practice, start now. Well, I can't just say, oh, my, here's your substrate, just look at it. If we can do that, we'll say, okay, here's emptiness. Emptiness right in front of you, just now realize emptiness. Go ahead. We're with it so easy. But when we, as we will tomorrow, say, okay, now attend to the space of the mind. Well, we did a little bit this morning. That should be something that we can just do. It should be thoughts on a higher realization. We see the substrate as the substrate, nakedly unadorned, without configuration, and the very important point, without the history. When you slip, and this is a fascinating point, and that is when you've achieved shamatha, and your coarse mind, and that means coarse mind with all its baggage, personal history, language, all the stuff of the psyche, with all of its conceptual network, all that dissolves, it melts. And when you've settled into your substrate consciousness, you've settled into something that's not even human. Substrate consciousness is not human, it's not a secret, it's not an immortal human soul. It's not human. It certainly doesn't have any gender either. It doesn't have gender now. It's subgender, subspecies. So it's there, so that's why I like to call the substrate consciousness stem consciousness. Stem consciousness. So a stem cell can turn into a neuron, a bone marrow cell, and so forth and so on, but it's not already. It depends on where it winds up in the body. And then it gets acculturated, so to speak. It gets a personal history. Welcome to bone marrow country. I need to be a bone marrow cell. Welcome. Join the club. Right? And so, when you are observing the substrate from the perspective of substrate consciousness, then you're getting an unadorned, naked, direct realization. You know it. Just like I just tasted water. It doesn't get any more naked than that. Okay? That wasn't English water, American water, just water. I can't say that my experience was completely devoid of acculturation, but that was pretty direct. This is more direct. When you're perceiving the substrate consciousness, that's just naked, distilled, with no additions, no additives, so to speak. Now, when we're attending to the Dharma Dhatu, the domain of experience of mental events, so not ultimate Dharma, as you know, among the 18 Dhatus, domain of mental experience. Number one, can we identify it quite quickly? Yeah, just think a thought and observe it. Mary had a little lamb, recited it. And now the next line, whose fleece was white as snow. by simply directing your attention to that little nursery, you have shot the arrow of your attention right into the Dhammadhatu. And then if you say, Narayana, little lamb, please was white as snow, stop. And keep your attention. Little lamb, please was white as snow, if you give you the target dissolves, the arrow remains right where it lies, the messenger on it, the domain of the one. So that's how you find it. That is, Dishwaratma taught me this 35 years ago. And that is, this is how you find it. Give yourself a target. It's like skeet. Pull. You know, your shotgun was pointed at the sky when you directed it to skeet, unless it's, you know, the skeet happens to be near your friend's face and you shoot him in the face. Then that's good. I love American politics. So, skeet, face, not skeet. In any case, the skeet, that is, you found the sky. And then the skeet's gone, but your rifle's still pointing right into the sky, pointing in the right direction. Right? And so, then how do you know you're still there? That is, when you track it, and as soon as it's vanished, if you haven't moved, then you know you're in the right place. But then the mind wanders. And you could be wandering after the visual, the auditory, and so forth and so on. So now, how do you know? And of course, you can always throw up another seat, pull, and put up another meritatus, or a mental image of what happened. You can always do that. But at some point, you really shouldn't need to do that. You do it as long as you need. It's like counting the breath. But at some point, you're just going to, you'll know I'm in the right place. And how do you know? And here's the answer to your question. And that is, when you're attending, wherever you're attending, and as soon as a thought comes up, a mental image, as soon as it comes up, you're right there. You didn't need to move. You were already attending to the place it showed up. Then you were in the right place. That's it. So, is that the whole? I think it was the whole thing. Now let's go, I'm going to set these aside. These will be has-beens. These are the will-bees. Questions or comments? Yes, we start with you, Jusha. And a microphone coming for you.
Thank you. I also relate to the substrate. So the substrate, and when you are meditating on the substrate and the mind in another state,
yeah,
it is similar as you are in a lucid dream that it's happening in the substrate, by the substrate, and then you are lucid. You are not changing anything. You are just lucid, seeing what is happening. And it's the same when you are practicing, when you are just watching images, and then one of these images is a video now.
Mm-hmm.
Just it's moving, it's happening something.
Mm-hmm.
But you are present, that you are aware.
Mm-hmm.
You are not caught by the,
right,
by the video.
Right.
It is the same as in a lucid dream. And when you are watching these videos, when you start creating it like a fantasy, like a plan,
right,
then it's not automatically that comes from the substrate. You are creating.
That's right. That's right. That's
so you have got lost because you are not being aware that you are creating something. You are just watching your creation, right? And,
okay.
And the final is that at the end, it gives you a lot of clarity. And do you have this amount of clarity, acceptation comes and rumination attacks you.
Right.
So how to stay in that clarity?
Okay. Good. Let's take, this is an enormously close parallel. And I keep on coming back to green, because it's just such a strong parallel. When the Buddha said, who are you? And he finally says, no, I'm not a man, I'm awake. That's really a powerful parallel. Okay, if he's awake, then what are we? Well, asleep, but what kind of sleep? There's stuff happening. So, compare it in the dream. And so, let's take this analogy, and that is a lucid dream. Now, I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here, but it will be short. And that is, I've often taught lucid dreaming and dreaming, a combination of the two. And now and again, people who are receiving the teaching, I mean, for the practice, have a background in Jungian psychology, or Freudian, but especially Jungian psychology, with a strong emphasis on the archetypes and understanding the symbolism and not messing with it and seeing the wisdom that may be coming from your subconscious or maybe even the collective unconscious, and don't mess with it. There's a message coming through here, and you should be picking up the message and not messing with the message, right? And so the question has been posed, if you become lucid, and then you start practicing dream yoga, and you start transforming the dream, if that is an integral feature or phase of dream yoga practice, of really exercising your ability to transform the dream objectively and your own presence in the dream, and just seeing how malleable it is. So some ask, but then you're really messing up the dream, then you won't pick up the symbolism that's coming through. And the answer is, and I heard this from Stephen Levera, because he's heard this probably countless times by now, is that the average person will have 5 to 7 dreams per night, or dream cycles per night. A person who's very good at lucid dreaming may have one of those cycles be lucid every night. Maybe two. More than that would be extremely rare. Which means you've got tons of dreams left over, just to observe. So chill, maybe if you change just one or two of them, it should be really okay, right? So I think it's a good answer. Did you change some of them? Well, if there's some really important message from the subconscious, let it get back to you. Come again, and I won't change it next time. But now, this relates to your question, and that is, to be lucid in the dream doesn't necessarily by any means mean that you're not changing anything. But to be lucid in the dream doesn't mean that you necessarily are. You can be lucid and just observe whatever's taking place, and you can just go kind of like through it like mist. You can be disembodied in a lucid dream. You can look for your body and not find it. You can simply be a disembodied presence in a lucid dream. And not, as far as you can tell, really explicitly or deliberately influencing anything. You can simply know that it's a dream. You can do that. So to be lucid doesn't mean you're necessarily tweaking it, manipulating it, like that. Right? At the same time, you may be lucid and you may be changing things all over the place, big time. Okay? So likewise, rumination is marching backwards away from enlightenment. Because you're in a little mini samsara. It started in ignorance, it flourished in delusion, and it's going pretty much out of habit. And by the way, oh yeah, you're between the fangs of the mental affections. So it's just marching directly away from the mind, away. So rumination as the semi-conscious, rather unaware, automatic, habitual thinking that we're all familiar with. I don't need to describe it, well, we know it as lying. That's not useful. It's not useful any more than I don't think it's ever really preferable to be non-lucid versus lucid. Why would it be? Why would it be preferable to be deluded rather than know reality as it is? Right? So one can say, well, every non-lucid dream you're having, then you're kind of reinforcing delusion. So the more lucid we can be, the better. Having said that, though, as we are now coming to this practice, and our time is now, as we're settling the mind, as natural state, the idea is to be lucid all the time. And that is, in the lucid dream, you recognize the dream as the dream. That's it, you're lucid. In the practice of settling the mind, you're recognizing mental events as mental events, and that's it. Moment to moment to moment, whatever's coming up, you're recognizing for what they are. They are simply mental events arising in the space of the mind, and you recognize them as such. And if you bring some insight into it, then you also recognize or realize the three marks of existence, all the better. But just flat-out shaman, prior to Vipassana, is at least you're not fundamentally deluded about the very nature of the stuff you're experiencing. You're not taking mental events as being people, or places, or situations. It's just mental events. So within lucidity, or that is setting the mind as natural state, you're lucid. But when you're not setting the mind as natural state, you may think lucidly. And that is, you may think about something. And do so consciously. With full consciousness, you're a participant. Now you're like in a lucid dream, but you're tweaking with the dream. You're changing it, transforming it, directing it, and so forth and so on. But you know what you're doing all the way along. In this case, what's the problem? No problem at all. When you're doing shamatha practice, of settling the mind as an natural state, then, by the instructions, you're not messing with it. You're lucid, but you're not transforming it. Because the whole idea is to allow it to unravel, to follow its own evolution. Its own devolution dissolving back into. And you'll interrupt that flow if you start getting in there and messing with it. That's your shamatha. When we go into vipassana, then we're more actively investigating, and we may even start running experiments. Like we ran the experiment, feelings arising in the body. Okay, now observe them negatively. Now pile on the rumination. My knee is killing me. My knee is probably swelling. Maybe it's purple by now. Maybe I'll need surgery. Maybe I'm becoming arthritic. Maybe I'll need to amputate. Maybe I'm going to hop around for a while. I'm one leg. Could happen. And now I'm really killing. And so we ran an experiment. And lo and behold, yeah, it actually makes the pain increase by adding all the stuff on. We can do all of that lucidly. But you are definitely messing with it. Right? So within the context of lucidity, you can simply be passively aware of. At the same time, note the impact of your quiet, passive observation on the observer and see whether there is an impact. Probably is, be a good guess. And those times when you deliberately reinvestigate or even start to transform, which you can do it with lucidity, knowing. Okay? Very good.
Very good.
And the clarity comes, lucidity, I mean, I think the word is well chosen, but the clarity comes by paying close attention.
How to hold it.
What's that?
How to hold it.
How to hold it by being really interested. That's it. By taking real things. If people can be interested in moving their finger back and forth, they can be interested in anything. If you can be interested in your breath, if you can actually get interested in your breath, so much so that it actually becomes interesting and it actually appears to you as interesting, then you have really developed the ability to be interested. if you're waiting in the doctor's office, and somebody wants to engage you, maybe a gorgeous woman, just you know, drop dead gorgeous, and she just really wants to strike up a conversation. She says, excuse me, sir, but haven't we met before? And she just says, I'm sorry, but I'm doing something so interesting, I just don't have time. Then you really don't know how to be interested. She's going to go. She's going to go. Even if you date for a while, she's... You've met, right? You're going to party. So why waste time? The breath is a keeper. You're going to have that as long as you're alive. So, you know, make long-term friendships. She's going to get old, too. She's not going to be that gorgeous that long. Whereas you're breathing, it'd be just as beautiful now as it is, you know, 20 years ago. Okay, you're about to have dinner. I'm heading off to have dinner with Klaus tonight, and a guest from out overseas. So, final big opportunity. Eating is one of those cases where we actually get all five senses piling in. Okay, you'll pick it up. The fragrance, very likely, you get near the door. You'll see it. Good chefs know how important the visual display is. You'll hear yourself eating. Not that interesting, but there are sounds coming up. Just mastication. The taste, of course. And so you, and the texture, and that's also very important in preparing food, right texture, right food. And so you're going to have all of my senses being activated there, and then you may have different feelings. Something may look good, like durian looks quite nice. I think most people think it smells disgusting, and some people find the taste is really good. So they're very selective. Maybe with a clothespin over there. Or somehow just are so. I think people who enjoy durian have very good samadhi. Because you manage to avoid the smell and enjoy the taste. That, I think that's some samadhi. Does anybody really. I mean, do you enjoy the smell of durian? You do. Well, you just expanded my bandwidth of what is possible. I didn't think that was possible. But of course, I like work with cheese. Blue cheese. And it pretty much smells like rotten socks, too. But in the right amount, it's incredible. So I'm a mutant, too. I'm just an American mutant rather than an Asian. So there you are, certain feelings arising by way of all of my physical senses. Tomorrow we move on to the mind. Enjoy your evening. See you tomorrow morning.